The headlines: the US, the UK and Australia announced a security pact that will help Canberra build the nuclear-powered submarines, a move that has provoked China's protest. Iran criticizes the UN nuclear agency for not taking a clear position on terrorist acts against the civilian nuclear facilities of its member states. Also in the headlines, rights groups say a new policing bill that is debated in the UK risks driving a wedge between police and members of the public. We'll have a report from London. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Top story this hour: the United States, Britain and Australia announced the formation of a security partnership that will help Canberra build nuclear-powered submarines. The partnership was announced by the leaders of the three countries in a virtual meeting. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said the submarines would be built in Australia in close cooperation with the United States and the UK. Morrison said Australia will not be fielding nuclear weapons and continue to meet its nuclear non-proliferation obligations. US President Joe Biden said the alliance would ensure peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific for the long term. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson asserted that the partnership would make the world safer. China also reacted to the alliance, saying countries should shake off their Cold War mentality and ideological prejudice. Political commentator Richard Becker says the formation of a security partnership to help Canberra build nuclear-powered submarines is declaring a Cold War against China.
If anyone had any doubt about what the purpose of this was, we had President Biden, who talked about the great friendship between the U.S. and the U.K. and Australia over a century, and all he cited were wars. World War I, World War II, the Korean War, I think he mentioned, the Gulf War, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War. I mean, it was all references to war, I think, making it clear to anyone who's trying to evaluate what they're seeing before them, is that this is another step in the pivot to Asia, the U.S. policy, bringing more of its allies into the surrounding of China with military power, U.S. military power, and the power of its allies. And really, this is detrimental to the people of China, for the people of Australia, to the people of the United States. This is not needed in any way, shape, or form, but it's part of the step up in militarism, and particularly, as the Chinese representative said, this is the Cold War against China threatening to become a hot war.
For the first time since the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in mid-August, the first Iranian commercial flights have landed at Kabul International Airport. Amin Alami reports from Kabul.
Nowadays, landings of local and international flights in Kabul International Airport has turned into a familiar scene. On Wednesday, the first official flight of Iran's Mahan Airlines landed in Kabul since Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in mid-August.
Iran's Mahan Airlines flight landed in Kabul International Airport with over a dozen Iranian passengers. It would return with tens of passengers, including Afghan nationals.
Earlier, some Qatari and UN-related aircrafts had resumed their flights to and from Kabul International Airport.
There is a Qatari aircraft landing here in the Kabul International Airport. According to Taliban sources, they are struggling to attract more foreign support, especially when it comes to managing the issue of Kabul International Airport.
In the meantime, the Taliban welcomed the resumption of Iran's commercial flights to Kabul, calling on international community to add to the number of their flights, bringing humanitarian aids to Afghanistan.
We welcome the resumption of the international flights, but the fact is our countrymen need urgent humanitarian aid. So I think the resumption of such flights paves the way for the regional countries and international bodies to send more humanitarian aid to Afghanistan.
Tehran was one of the largest donors at the 2002 Tokyo conference, pledging more than India, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey, Norway, Switzerland, Australia, and Pakistan combined. Iran is also hosting around 3 million Afghans, including around 1 million refugees and 2 million undocumented migrants, according to the United Nations. Many of them have been residing for more than 4 decades. Kabul International Airport resumes its commercial international flights, while Qatar and Taliban are jointly managing all security and technical issues of the airport. However, Taliban officials here say they are working to make Kabul International Airport fully operational. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Iran has slammed as regrettable what it calls the International Atomic Energy Agency's silence about Israel's nuclear program. Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, was responding to a comment by an Israeli envoy. The Israeli official had said the IAEA has been in the dark about Iran's nuclear program for 7 months. Gharibabadi described the remark as absurd, as it came from a regime that isn't a member of any disarmament treaty. The Iranian diplomat noted that while Tehran is implementing the safeguards, the IAEA has had no information about Israel's nuclear program for well over 5 decades. And Iran says no one should expect the Islamic Republic to curb its peaceful nuclear activities while U.S. sanctions are still in place. Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency has criticized the European signatories of the nuclear deal for trying to switch the places of victim and violator. From Vienna, Homolesky reports.
Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says until U.S. sanctions are not removed, no one should expect more forbearance from the Islamic Republic. Kazem Gharibabadi told the IAEA's Board of Governors Iran's nuclear activities, including enrichment at higher levels and production of metallic-based uranium fuel, are completely peaceful, under IAEA safeguards, and in line with the country's rights under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
They asked Iran to go back to the full implementation of its commitment under the deal. So I said, no, it's not possible. So our nuclear program will continue. And if there are some specific actions that we have taken and are going beyond and are beyond the JCPOA provisions, we will suspend them only in case of lifting of sanctions.
Gharibabadi criticized the European signatories of the deal for refusing to condemn the illegal unilateral withdrawal of the US. Apparently, he said, they intend to switch the places of victim and violator. Talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the JCPOA have not resumed since June. The aim of the negotiations, in which the US took part indirectly, is to bring Washington and Tehran back into full compliance. Iran says the outcome of talks to revive the nuclear deal should be the effective and verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions and guarantee that disastrous decisions like the U.S. withdrawal and violations do not reoccur. Iran also informed the board that one of the IAEA's equipment was destroyed in an act of sabotage, widely blamed on Israel, targeting an Iranian nuclear workshop. It's regrettable, Gharibabadi said, that the agency has failed to take a clear position on such terrorist acts against the civilian nuclear facilities of its member states. Homolesky, Vienna.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has begun reshuffling his cabinet, removing those ministers who have been seen as underperforming. Downing Street confirmed that Education Secretary Gavin Williamson, the Justice Secretary Robert Buckland, and Housing Secretary Robert Jenrick have left. Williamson was highly criticized for his handling of pandemic-related school closures. Dominic Raab has also been axed as Foreign Secretary and has been appointed Justice Secretary, replacing Buckland. Raab, who came under fire for the handling of the Afghanistan crisis, has been given an additional role of Deputy Prime Minister. A spokesman for Johnson said the goal is to put a team in place to deliver on public priorities The last major reshuffle came in February 2020 when Johnson axed around half of his cabinet colleagues following Brexit. Davina Taylor says British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is as much to blame for as his top ministers for underperformance on several issues.
Because essentially, the men who he's had carry the can in the shape of Gavin Williamson, the now ousted education secretary, for how COVID was handled in the education sector, well, you could say Boris and the rest of his team could easily have been ousted by that very reason. So the fact that one minister here gets to represent the ministerial departments that messed up during COVID is laughable, actually. The fact then that Dominic Raab, the man who seemed to have spectacularly mishandled the Afghanistan situation, well, where was Boris Johnson when that was also kicking off? So there's so many questions here about tinkering around the edges whilst Rome burns, because the timing of this is also incredibly crucial, and some might say slightly suspicious. After all, this is the evening that the Labour Party is debating the very serious case of the near £1,000 in universal credit that the very poorest will be losing, depending on how the government decides to push forward. So could this reshuffle be actually a move to try and get some of that attention away from what the Labour Party is trying to do here?
Staying in the UK, where a new policing bill is being debated that risks widening the wedge between police officers and members of the public, according to rights groups. Ahmed Cabello has more with this report from London.
Is the UK turning into a totalitarian state? Well, according to former British Home Secretary David Blunkett, they are certainly heading in that direction, with the proposed police crime and sentencing courts bill, which is being debated this week. He's not alone. 600,000 Brits put their name to a petition calling for the bill to be dropped, including 700 academics. 245 organisations have also called the bill an attack on fundamental rights, along with three UN special rapporteurs and the UK's Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, who called the bill, quote, oppressive and wrong. While there are many aspects of the legislation that has worried rights groups and advocates since the bill was proposed, there is one particular aspect that has recently begun raising eyebrows.
The bill proposes to increase the sentence length for assault on emergency workers from 12 months to 2 years. On the surface, this may seem appropriate, but what some activists are concerned about is the way that this will disproportionately target people from ethnic minority backgrounds who are already significantly more likely to have force used against them than their white counterparts.
Dean alleges he was attacked by British police officers back in 2013 in the city of Manchester, but somehow found himself charged with resisting arrest.
But again, I'm 6'2", quite a big lad. Straight away, the police officer see my body as a weapon, and I got the whole, he's resisting. Next thing you know, I've got six police officers on my back, like punching me, kicking me, doing whatever. They can do things to people like me and people like you, with the full knowledge that the law fully protects them. And even when, like I say, when I was basically attacked by the police, all of the officers who were there kind of corroborated the same story, which was false.
Marco, not his real name, has a similar story. He was at an anti-racist demonstration when police were seen attacking protesters, yet Marco found himself charged with assaulting emergency services. Marco asked us to distort his voice.
The police was using me.
This was clear in court by the footages that the police were using disproportionate force, and there was no real reason for doing that. And they even confirmed that in their witness testimony in court. And it was incredible to see that they could just claim in court that they were just punching people in the face to stop them from going to Trafalgar Square. And this was used against me, ultimately, just because I was defending myself and those around me.
Ahmed Cabello, London.
Spain's Prime Minister and Catalonia's regional leader say their positions on independence remained very far apart. The two sides made the remark after Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez paid a visit to the region to resume talks aimed at reviving ties. Relations were badly damaged after Catalonia's failed 2017 independence bid. Regional President Pierre Aragonés demanded that Spain authorize a referendum on independence as well as an amnesty for everyone involved in the failed independence bid. Sanchez, however, said Madrid is opposed to both ideas. In October 2017, the Catalan regional government staged a referendum banned by Madrid and then issued a short-lived declaration of independence that triggered a heavy-handed crackdown by Madrid. Political commentator Leos Sazdi joined us earlier with his analysis on why Catalan independence will be unlikely in the near future. Take a listen.
The opinion polls show that the right, and that will be the popular party that is center-right and Vox, that is the right, I mean, the left usually call it far-right, but it's not far-right, this is the right, the pure right, while the popular party, which has a majority in the opinion polls now, is the center-right. If they govern together, rule like in the autonomous region of Madrid or in Murcia, or in Andalusia, more Andalusia, Madrid, then, you know, the socialists lose the next elections. Pedro Sánchez can only stay till 2023, you see? So they set a date for a new referendum, but probably with the idea that we socialists are not going to be because in government, because we're going to lose, and then they leave the hot potato to the right, a new government made of the right and center-right. And then they would not allow the referendum, even if that leads to a small civil war or civil conflict. The right is never going to allow Catalonia to go its own way.
The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen claims the EU has achieved a lot because member states have stuck together. However, her State of the Union address in the European Parliament on Wednesday was met with a great deal of scepticism by lawmakers. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
in the limelight.
A new analysis shows that a large portion of Pentagon contracts in recent years have gone to just five companies: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, Up to Half of the $14 trillion spent by Pentagon since 9/11 has gone to war profiteers. Stay tuned for more. To half of the estimated $14 trillion that the Pentagon has spent in the two decades since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan has gone to private military contractors, with corporate behemoths such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Dynamics hovering up much of the money. That's according to a new paper authored by William Harting, director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy, and released recently by Brown University's Cost of War Project. Published just days after the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks and 2 weeks after the last U.S. military plane departed Afghanistan, the paper documents the extent to which the massive post-9/11 surge in Pentagon spending benefited weapon makers, logistics firms, private security contractors, and other corporate interests. The magnitude of Pentagon spending in the wake of 9/11 attacks was remarkable, Harting observes. The increase in U.S. military spending between fiscal year 2002 and fiscal year 2003 was more than the entire military budget of any other country, including major powers like China, Russia, the U.K., Germany, and France. According to Harting's analysis, from one-third to one-half of Pentagon's $14 trillion in spending since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan on October 21 went to defense contractors, which spend heavily on government lobbying. A large portion of these contracts, one-quarter to one-third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years, have gone to just five major corporations: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, Harting writes, adding, the $75 billion in Pentagon contracts received by Lockheed Martin in fiscal year 2020 is well over one and one-half times the entire budget for the State Department and Agency for International Development for that year, which totaled $44 billion. But those five corporate giants are far from the only companies that profited from the increase in U.S. Defense Department outlays following the Afghanistan invasion, which ultimately killed more than 46,000 Afghan civilians. Harting notes that numerous other firms, including Eric Prince's since rebranded Blackwater, the Dick Cheney tied company Halliburton, and DynCorp, benefited handsomely from the Pentagon spending boom. Halliburton's Pentagon contracts grew more than tenfold from FY 2002 to FY 2006 on the strength of its contracts to rebuild Iraq's oil infrastructure and provide logistical support for U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, the new paper reads, adding, by 2009, over half of DynCorp revenues were coming from the Iraq and Afghan wars.
Arteng argues that the Pentagon's growing reliance on private contractors to carry out U.S. foreign policy in the aftermath of 9/11 attacks raises multiple questions of accountability, transparency, and effectiveness. This is problematic because privatizing key functions can reduce the U.S. military's control of activities that occur in war zones while increasing risks of waste, fraud, and abuse, he writes, adding, additionally, that the waging of war is a source of profits can contradict the goal of having the U.S. lead the diplomacy in seeking to resolve conflicts. In order to rein in war profiteering and increase government accountability over private firms involved in conducting or preparing for war, Hartung recommends several broad policy changes, including slashing overall spending on war and military operations overseas, increasing the role of diplomacy in U.S. foreign policy, implementing more strict regulations and strengthening the role of inspectors general, auditors, and contracting officers in rooting out corruption, and enacting revolving door reforms such as longer cooling off periods between government service and employment in the arms industry, closing loopholes in current laws, and increasing detailed reporting on revolving door employment. Reducing the profits of war ultimately depends on reducing the resort to war in the first place, Harting writes. Likewise, making war less profitable decreases the incentive to go to war. Given the immense financial and human costs of America's post-9/11 wars and the negative security consequences generated by many of these conflicts, adopting a new, less militarized foreign policy should be a central goal of the public and policymakers alike, unquote.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady here from IRIB English Radio. In the studio, as always, I have the pleasure and honor of having my lovely sister and friend and wonderful guest, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister.
On the previous episode of Muslim Lady, we were talking about two important techniques or tips or principles one must consider if a Muslim lady wants to step into the very pleasurable and beneficial path of self-care. Number one was time management, as you mentioned, Sister Razia. You complemented it with a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his technique and method of time management and the Quran's instructions regarding this matter. Pray first, real simple, real straightforward. The second point was mindfulness. It's just a matter of terminology. You think that, oh, mindfulness is something that these new YouTubers have coined and you see it in motivational Instagram posts. But I think the Quran talks about mindfulness like a kajillion times. It just uses different phrases.
Exactly.
Right?
I just want to recite one beautiful Quranic verse where I got mindfulness from this. It says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ رِجَالٌ لَا تُلْهِيهِمْ تِجَارَةٌ وَلَا بَيْعٌ عَنْ ذِكْرِ اللَّهِ وَإِقَامِ الصَّلَاةِ وَإِيتَاءِ الزَّكَاةِ يَخَافُونَ يَوْمًا تَتَغَلَّبُ فِيهِ الْقُلُوبُ وَالْأَبْصَارِ. So these men, whom neither trading nor bargaining distracts from the remembrance of Allah. In the midst of their business deals with two important corporations, two different countries, it's a subhanAllah that in the midst of even that, they are constantly remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the material world does not distract them from iqam as-salat wa ita' as-zakat, from, you know, praying and giving zakat, because they are fearful of a day. Everything, mindfulness, the roots of my mindfulness is the day of judgment.
Yes.
That definitely. You have that picture ahead of you, and your eyes are fixed on that. Whatever you want to do, is look at that picture. Look at that picture. Look at that picture.
Beautiful.
Right?
Yeah. And to constantly remind yourself that you're more than this 1, 2, 3 days that you spend on in this world, that there's an actual eternal future awaiting you, that you're going to meet the consequences of every single action you conduct here in an abode that will last forever. When you have that sort of picture of yourself and the quality of your existence, you don't feel like YOLO, you only live once, let's just see what happens, who cares, you know? You're like, no, this is going to last forever, so I better make it last.
Exactly.
I better make it worthwhile.
One of my friends who watches a lot of Life After Life, it's like those people who have had the near-death experiences, and the way they explain things, that little things that they have done in this world turns into great, unbelievable phenomenons in the other world.
Right.
And this way, this is just a very tangible way for us to really believe in the hereafter and believe in the impact of what we're doing here. You know, and sometimes we're not realizing, Zainab, how much impact we as individuals are having on the lives of other people without knowing.
That's true. That's so true.
Little things, but we are sometimes shaping the fate of a person.
Mm.
So we are responsible.
For sure.
So this is tip mindfulness. The third tip, which I have just briefly mentioned in our previous episodes, is the quality of your time or your relationship in your family with your spouse and with your children. Self-care would be influential, would work well, would function, would give result only when you are living in an atmosphere that is peaceful. So be very careful. And also, there are a lot of many researches that say that people who are in happy relationships, who are living in good families, they have healthier bodies.
I swear to God.
Healthier minds, healthier souls, healthier whatever.
Exactly.
So, self-care, take care of your family.
Exactly.
We are, inshallah, going to mention that the noble prophet, in a hadith from him, we read that several things are of the traits of the prophets, one of which is good intimacy with one's spouse. An intimacy, sexual relationship, it has introductions.
Right.
I mean, you should be having a good non-intimate relationship before intimacy to have a good intimate relationship.
Exactly. Don't approach her like...
like
roosters and hens, I believe His Eminence says.
Exactly. So if you want to, you know, one ray of light of self-care is one important part, one important share, portion of self-care is in how you are treating your spouse and how you're treating your family.
We're going to go on a short break and we're going to be right back, so don't go anywhere.
Thank you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Muslim Lady, and we are discussing the importance of self-care in Islam and its examples.
I love this story. I'm just going to share with you so much.
Absolutely.
That I will, you know, repeat it so many times, 1,000 times if I have to.
Wonderful.
So a couple of these ladies at the time of the Prophet, they went to the Prophet and they complained of their husbands. We are sometimes, we have problems with our husbands and we can't go anywhere. We just have to go to the court and, you know, that's when you want to get a divorce, right? Otherwise, if you want to, who do you have to refer to a psychologist? That's the best you can go
exactly.
to. And then the psychologist has no authority, has no position to say anything to your spouse.
Yeah, exactly. And oftentimes I found that psychologists that are too obsessed with the psychology part of it, they forsake the spiritual Islamic part. Those who are totally Islamic and religious, they don't understand the psychology part, and it sucks. There's no balance. We need Rasulullah.
Seriously, imagine. And also I read like some similar stories that like some ladies would go to like Imam Ali alayhi salam and say that like they were complaining, and Imam Ali alayhi salam personally took their matters into his hand and he fixed the problem himself.
Beautiful.
Imagine a religious leader.
An infallible
religious
authority.
Leader.
Exactly, that's beautiful. And then what happened?
Anyways, so they came to the Prophet and they said that our husbands have three problems.
Oh no.
They don't eat meat, they don't use perfume, and they said that our husbands do not have intimate relationships with us. So the Prophet got so
distressed
and upset that he rushed to the mosque where his abba was, you know, dragging on the floor. He was so enraged. He went to the mosque, he sat on the pulpit, and he said, "What has happened to some of my companions? I, as your prophet, I eat meat, I use perfume, and I, you know, get close to my wives. Any of you who does not like my sunnah is not considered as a part of me." So,
and he talked some senses back into these men.
Exactly.
And forbade them from a life of celibacy.
The definition of Islam is a life full of vivacity, full of halal joys,
cheerfulness,
laughter, excitement, good, rich families. This is Islam, right?
And by rich, we don't necessarily mean like money rich.
No. Yeah. Rich, spiritually rich.
Exactly.
Right? It's like a caricature Islam that they have understood of.
And it's taken out of context as well.
Exactly.
And how often is the religion of God mutilated and utterly destructed because of this heinous habit of taking things out of context? I mean, when it comes to verses of the Quran, we're so quick to say that, oh no, you can't talk about the verses about jihad, kill them and arrest them and destroy them wherever you meet them out of context. It has to be read in context. Those were peculiar, specific circumstances, and it's not like we can just walk around and kill disbelievers now. When it comes to that, they're quick to defend, they're quick to emphasize on the importance of context and other conditions. But when it comes to the right of the most closest person to them in their lives, the person who single-handedly holds the prosperity of their dunya and akhirah and their children, they become so oppressive, and it's so sad.
Yeah. Of course, many Muslim men also are extremely careful of the rights of their wives. I've seen some, you know, men who pay so much attention to the sexual needs of their wives, seriously. And to all the ahadith that we have about this intimate relationship, they pay close attention. You know, they first meet the needs of their wives, and then once she's satisfied, they would go to their own needs. So there are, alhamdulillah, good, religious, pious, caring men.
God-fearing men.
I've seen them.
May Allah increase them in number. And in sustenance and strength.
Seriously. Because the better the spousal relationship, the better your efficiency at work,
yes.
the better person, the happier you are in the society.
The better sleep you get, the more energetic you are physically.
The better offspring.
Yeah, exactly.
Your generation is going to, you know. Mm.
And how much Islam has laid emphasis on reproduction? Exactly.
Right?
There's no
institution more beloved in the eyes of Allah than family, than marriage.
Beautiful.
Right? That was the third point. The fourth point is that one self-care tip, according to the teachings of Islam, is taking a short midday nap.
For real?
Yeah.
Oh, I hate napping.
I love it.
For real? I wake up so languid.
You know why? Because this has to follow the Islamic sunnah. The whole, your whole life system has to be the Islamic way, so that the nap would fit in. There's a rivaya, there's a narration that says that if you want to help your nightly vigils, take day naps.
Mm.
Because for the lack of sleep that you have throughout the night, because, you know, Islamically speaking, after sunset, you know, we have to sleep after sunset.
Mm, pray Maghrib, Isha, sleep.
Sleep. And then you keep waking up numerously. وَمِنَ اللَّيْلِ فَتَهَجَّتْ
Before dawn.
Nafila.
Right.
Right? So you do a lot of tahajjud throughout the night. Then you wake up early in the morning.
Right.
Like after your Fajr prayer,
you're up.
You're up.
Yeah.
Your life starts.
Exactly. You go about your day and then...
And it increases your memory.
Ah, well, that explains a lot. Thank you so much, Sister Rosie, and thank you, brothers and sisters, for being with us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out aloud that on that day I'll be okay.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Atmospheric measurements show that deforestation and rapid local warming have reduced or eliminated the capacity of the eastern Amazonian forest to absorb carbon dioxide, with worrying implications for future global warming. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Scott Denning, author. This article is published under the heading Southeast Amazonia is no longer a carbon sink. Stay tuned for more. Since at least the inception of modern records of atmospheric carbon dioxide levels in 1950s, there has been a small global excess, about 2%, in the amount of CO2 taken up by land plants for photosynthesis, compared with the amount emitted as a result of the decomposition of organic material. This land carbon sink has absorbed around 25% of all fossil fuel emissions since 1960. Offsetting some global warming. Tropical forests have been a major component of the land carbon sink, and the largest intact tropical forest is in Amazonia. Writing in Nature, Gatti et al. Report extensive direct sampling of the atmosphere over this region. Their data reveal that western Amazonia is still a relatively weak carbon sink, but suggest that deforestation and warming over eastern Amazonia have degraded or even reversed regional uptake of carbon by the forest. The sink arises from a combination of the increased vegetation growth that occurs in response to rising levels of CO2 and other nutrients, changes in land management and ecosystem responses to climate change. Tropical forests are Earth's most productive ecosystems, but they're not recovering from past human disturbances as their counterparts at mid-latitudes have done, nor are they benefiting from the markedly longer growing seasons associated with climate change, as are boreal and Arctic ecosystems. Carbon has accumulated in the biomass of Amazonian forests for decades, but studies in the past few years suggest that Amazonian carbon sinks are threatened by deforestation and forest degradation, progressive drying of the climate, and fires. However, it is difficult to make direct measurements that reflect the local carbon balance of many Amazonian ecosystems because access to those regions is limited, and it is hard to extrapolate available local data across the whole region because Amazonian ecosystems vary enormously. Satellite measurements of atmospheric levels of CO2 and carbon monoxide, a tracer of combustion, and of solar-induced fluorescence from vegetation, a proxy for photosynthesis, show that the year-to-year carbon balance in Amazonia is quite sensitive to drought and fire. However, persistent cloud cover in this region complicates the acquisition of such measurements, and the collection of these data began only about a decade ago. Direct measurements of the atmosphere could constrain estimates of regional carbon balance, but are spares for Amazonia. Intergadian colleagues who have directly measured the atmosphere in four regions across Amazonia for 9 years. The authors used aircraft to collect air samples from near the surface up to an altitude of 4.5 kilometers at each region, then analyze the samples to produce a vertical profile of the concentrations of a suite of gases, including CO2 and CO. The authors produced 590 vertical profiles during their study, with a typical sampling period of about twice a month at each region. Gatti et al. Also used data from several sites on remote islands and coastal headlands around the South Atlantic Ocean to establish background concentrations of gases. This allowed them to compute spatial gradients of CO2 and CO concentrations between the background sites in each of the profiled regions in Amazonia. The authors analyzed their data by season and by year and determined how the spatial patterns of CO2 and CO concentrations varied according to the region over which sample air had passed before collection. Finally, they used the seasonal CO2 concentration gradients to estimate regional carbon flux associated with forest growth and decay, and estimated carbon emissions produced by fires from the CO gradients. Northwestern Amazonia is almost always very wet and shows little seasonal variation in growth and decay. Gratti and colleagues' atmospheric profiling indicates that this region was close to carbon balance during the period of the study. About as much carbon was taken up by plants for growth as was emitted from decay processes. However, the moisture and fertility of Amazonian forests changes substantially further south and east. Dry seasons, periods with rainfall of less than 100 millimeters per month, get progressively longer, eventually lasting for 5 months or more as the forest grades into savanna. Gatti and colleagues find that the drier forests in the northeastern and southeastern regions studied were close to carbon balance during the wet season, but that carbon release from decomposition and fire tended to exceed carbon uptake by photosynthesis during the dry season. The observed regional and seasonal patterns of carbon uptake in the northwest transitioning to carbon release in the drier east were consistent with the year-to-year variability of the data, which revealed that greater carbon releases associated with decomposition and fire occur during hotter and drier years. Gatti and co-workers show that the transition of eastern Amazon forests from carbon sink to carbon source during the dry season is associated with a strong regional warming trends. Eastern Amazon sites have warmed by as much as about 6/10 degrees Celsius per decade during the dry season over the past 40 years. This is more than 3 times the rate of global warming and about the same rate as for the Arctic. West season and western Amazonian forests have warmed too, but at a much slower rate. Warming states in dry season for eastern Amazonia might have been amplified by deforestation and forest degradation. Getty et al. Conclude that increases in fires and in physiological stress, mortality, and decomposition of trees in this area are associated with increasing carbon loss from regional ecosystems. The authors have documented the accelerating transition of forests from carbon sinks to sources using direct measurements of large-scale gradients of atmospheric gas concentrations. The overall pattern of deforestation, warmer and drier, dry seasons, drought stress, fire, and carbon release in eastern Amazonia seriously threatens the Amazon carbon sink. Indeed, the results cast doubt on the ability of tropical forests to sequester large amounts of fossil fuel-derived CO2 in the future. For decades, ecologists have been surprised that the fraction of fossil fuel emissions absorbed by land ecosystems has remained fairly constant, even though these emissions have increased. Forests at high latitudes have continued to accumulate carbon because their growing seasons have lengthened as a result of climate change. Mid-latitude forests have done so because they have been recovering from past clearance and because they have benefited from the increased availability of nutrients produced as a result of human activities or mobilized in soils by climate warming. By contrast, increased carbon sequestration by tropical forests must be driven largely by an increase in photosynthesis associated with rising CO2 levels, but regional atmospheric profiling suggests that this carbon sink is threatened by forest degradation and warming. Another complication is that fossil fuel emissions must be quickly reduced to meet international climate targets, but it is not clear how the CO2-driven carbon sinks of tropical forests will respond to a rapidly warming world in which CO2 levels are no longer rising. The future of carbon accumulation in tropical forests has therefore long been uncertain. Getty and colleagues' atmospheric profiles show that the uncertain future is happening now.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.